Welcome. I'm Angie Coiro, and this is Your Call. Rose Aguilar is off today. And today is the second of two shows focusing on hate groups in the United States. You can find our first, that was September 12th, at yourcallradio.org. That hour focused on right-wing extremists in general. Today we narrow it down to neo-Nazis and white nationalists. New small groups of these extremists keep showing up on the sites that keep track of these things. New and old groups of white supremacists find each other online, where they recruit new members. They've staged demonstrations around the U.S. Their rallying cries target a wide range of marginalized communities, immigrants, Jewish people, people of color, and LGBTQ folks. The Southern Poverty Law Center estimated there were up to a dozen hate groups at the Washington, D.C. insurrection. The January 6th throng included a man in a T-shirt bearing the words, "Work means freedom." That's according to the New York Post. And that phrase in German was at the entrance to the Nazi death camp Auschwitz. In case there was any doubt, the man's T-shirt read, "Camp Auschwitz." Another participant, now sentenced to prison for his actions, liked to dress up as Adolf Hitler. These two were far from alone. As early as 2017, neo-Nazis were gathering in Charlottesville, marching with torches and chanting, "Jews will not replace us." They've shown up at Black Lives Matter events. A man who crashed his car into security banners at the White House in May had a Nazi flag and had written a speech for an anticipated coup. It ended with "Sieg Heil." And according to Truthout, exactly 1 week after the August 6th racist murder of three black people in Jacksonville, Florida, two neo-Nazi rallies were held in Orlando, where masked and uniformed men shouted racist and anti-Semitic slogans. The smaller of the two rallies was held at Disney World and organized by the Order of the Black Sun, a local neo-Nazi group. It drew about a dozen people who displayed slur-emblazoned banners and signs. According to Diego, an activist with the anti-fascist group Miami Against Fascism, he asked to be identified only by first name for safety reasons, similar Disney World rallies occur nearly every month. These are just the most recent examples of the rising threats by neo-Nazis in the United States. Who are these people? Why do they feel empowered in their hate? Who's enabling them? And what can we do about them? We have two guests to help us out with this. I'm pleased to be talking again with Charles Postol. He's professor of history at San Francisco State University and the author of Equality, An American Dilemma, 1866-1986, and The Populist Vision. He's also written about conservative and right-wing nationalist movements in recent U.S. history. Charles, welcome.
Thank you. Angie, glad to be with you.
Jeff Charlotte is a journalist, professor of English, and director of creative writing at Dartmouth College. He's the best-selling author of seven books, including The Undertow, Scenes from a Slow Civil War. Jeff, welcome back to the show.
Hi, Angie. Good to be with you again.
Let's talk definitions first. Who are these people? Charles, the white nationalist groups include what are widely called neo-Nazis. Now, what distinction is being drawn there between Nazis and neo-Nazis, and why the distinction?
The distinction between Nazis and neo-Nazis. Nazis after World War II were not particularly popular in the United States. And there was and over the last 70 plus years, there's been attempts to reinvent or reconnect or reestablish who they are. A little bit like chameleons changing what they are. And that's why we get neo-Nazis. Are they old Nazis in new form? It's just another way of saying reinvented Nazis.
Mm-hmm. Jeff, I'd like your take on this too. Does it serve to make that distinction?
I think for me, as a writer, the more important point is to look at this as a new and evolving fascism. To be honest, there's a small group of neo-Nazis. There's a much larger actual American fascist movement. You very rarely see the swastika flag, and I've encountered it, and I've dealt with these people. But you more often see, for instance, a flag flying right near my home of Trump as Rambo with a giant machine gun or Trump on the top of a tank. That's a fascist flag. That's cult of personality, the reverence for violence and so on. And that absorbs the neo-Nazis. But it's a lot bigger than the neo-Nazis, and they're just a little bit, maybe in their vernacular, the point of the spear of the real threat.
I want to get further into that, much further into that. But first, in continuing the idea of definitions, I think it's natural and usually accurate to think that the people we're talking about today are white, but they're not necessarily Anglo-Saxon people. Here are three examples. Sai Varshuth Khandelwal is from India. He smashed his car into White House barriers in May. Mass murderer who killed eight people at an Allen, Texas mall, also in May, Mauricio Garcia, had a swastika tattooed on his chest and SS on his arm. Now, he's Hispanic. That's two examples of something we've seen again and again. This is where it gets complicated. Enrique Tarrio chaired the Proud Boys until 2021. They showed up next to white supremacists at rallies, but the Institute for Strategic Dialogue makes this distinction. Classifying the Proud Boys as a hate group whose leaders and members have promoted white nationalist, anti-Muslim, and misogynist rhetoric, the Anti-Defamation League describes the group's ideology as alt-light, consisting primarily of misogyny, Islamophobia, transphobia, and anti-immigrant sentiment. The ADL explains that while the group is violent and nationalistic, their members present a range of ethnic backgrounds, and its leaders vehemently protest any allegations of racism. Neither of these organizations list the group as white supremacists. Wow. And that's just a mishmash of definitions and trying to separate out this group from that group. And then there's the idea that they would all be white, and they're not all white. So, Jeff, what's going on with that?
Well, again, there's the F word, fascism, that is going to work. Or authoritarianism, if you like, that's going to work to encompass this all. This is one of the arguments that I'm making in the undertow. I went to, for instance, a rally for Ashley Babbitt, and she was the white woman killed on January 6th by a police officer who happened to be a black man. Instantly became kind of a white martyr myth. And yet at the rally, about half the attendees and speakers were people of color. I watched Proud Boys, who included people of color, brawl with Antifa, who included people of color. And I think when we understand white supremacy versus white nationalism, white supremacy is, there's a historian named Anthea Butler in a great book called White Evangelical Racism. She writes about the promise of whiteness. Whiteness isn't real. It's a concept, and it can draw in. It's, you know, fascism's got a big gravitational force. It can draw in people from all sorts, who the idea that you too can have the benefits of this. And I think of this in some ways as the newest American contribution to fascism, a purely white nationalist movement. It's not going to work in a country as diverse as ours. But we live in a global fascist moment that is drawing internationally. And I think I'm so glad you start the program with this, because I think it's something we really need to be aware of. Mm-hmm. It's reassuring to us to think it's just the old Klansmen in the robes.
Yeah, and I'm glad you're drawing that distinction, too. Charles, how does this play out historically? It sounds like we had much more distinctive groups at the time. And I'm guessing we have the potential of social media and a much wider field of people to talk to. That means these groups are growing faster and they're growing independently of each other.
Yeah, as a historian, I'm not sure how much is new and how much has been around for a long time, and we just haven't been looking at it. We're looking at it now because we have a former president who's embracing these white power and fascist movements openly and leading them. That's why we're so alarmed by it, and why they are taking such a prominent place in our thinking right now. But they've been around for a long time. In the 1960s, we had the American Nazi Party, led by George Lincoln Rockwell, and he invented this idea that Nazis should back away from just the German paraphernalia from the old Nazi regime and adopt the slogan of white power. And this white power movement brought together Christian nationalists, Nazis like Rockwell, David Duke, who went from the American Nazi Party to the Ku Klux Klan. All of these groups share a common, and I agree with Jeff, fascist outlook, and are part of a broader fascist movement. And so I think the adaptability is important to think. And I think this idea of oh, they're not really racist, or they're not really white power advocates because they have people who aren't white in them. Mm-hmm. That's never how it's worked. They've always been able to attract people who have the fascist authoritarian mentality. People come from all races are attracted to these things. I mean, just look at Latin America, where we know this history is very strong. They just arrested important Nazi publicists down in Buenos Aires the other day. So this is these are global things, as Jeffrey's pointed out. I just point out that they've always been global, and they've always been complicated by the fact that white power or Nordic racialism has always not been just about whites or Nordics.
Boy, you brought up a good an extra layer there, Charles. And that, Jeff, that would be the Christian nationalist groups. There's an article from the New York Times not long ago, July, Black History is a Casualty in Ron DeSantis' Christian Nationalist Quest. Christian nationalism adds its own layer because, you know, now you're throwing God into the mix. Jeff, this is something you're well-versed in. So talk about making that distinction.
Well, I'll satisfy the believers and say God is always in the mix, right from the beginning. And it's part of, it's always been a part of American nationalism. Christian nationalism, though, is a term you didn't hear as often. You know, sometimes it was talked about as fundamentalism and so on. I think the distinction that people need to understand with Christian nationalism is it doesn't mean that you go to church. It might include the evangelical right. It might include the Catholic right, which the old fundamentalist coalition would not. But it also includes a lot of people who love the idea of America as a godly nation. And so, for instance, you see Proud Boys, you see Oath Keepers, all these armed groups invoking God. I've spoken to so many of these men. They're not churchgoers. They don't even have a denomination. This is not an American invention. I think, as Charles would say, that this kind of religious nationalism has an old history. I'm most familiar with it in my reporting in Russia in 2014, where Putin was developing this kind of Christian nationalism. That's one of the lowest church attendances in the world, but so many right-wing Russians love the idea of Russia as a holy nation.
Wow.
And now we have America as a holy nation and Hungary as a holy nation, you know, and, you know, so those religiosities, and it's not limited to Christianity. I mean, we could look at Indonesian fascism and the role of religion in it. It's always intermingled. There is no fascism that doesn't have a religious element.
Charles, I was just about to ask you, this is, you know, as Jeff said, this is not new. Going back to, although we're talking about the larger groups of fascists, let's go back for a moment to the neo-Nazis. Is there a strong thread of Christian concerns moving from the original Nazis into today's Nazis? How important was God to them in getting their message out there?
I mean, God is in the mix, as Jeffrey said, but I think a key figure here in this transition would be Gerald L.K. Smith. He was a member of Pelley's Silver Shirts, Brown Shirts in the 1930s, an admirer of Hitler. He launched an America First Party. Yes, the name is the same as the Trump name, America First Party, in 1943. And after the war, when Hitler was less popular, he turned this into the Christian Nationalist Crusade. It was the cross and the flag. It was about Holocaust denial, very conservative politics. And this became inherited by people like Pat Buchanan, Nixon speechwriter, Reagan communications director, a very similar politics of the where Hitler fascism and Christian nationalism begins and ends is pretty unclear in this evolution. You know, Pat Buchanan, he was a semi Holocaust denier or a soft Holocaust denier, very similar politics to Donald Trump, defended Nazi war criminals. This stuff has a long history, and where, you know, there are not sharp edges between Christian nationalism and neo-Nazism. They're all blended together.
That's Charles Postel, pardon me. He's a professor of history at San Francisco State. Jeff Charlotte with us as well. He's a journalist, professor of English, and director of creative writing at Dartmouth, and they are both accomplished authors. You both brought up the T word, and I was going to go there anyway. We're going to talk about Donald Trump and what kind of enabling is happening here, both from him and in his wake, what he's enabled once he's opened the door. Let me give you a quick list of things that we've seen with the GOP and with Donald Trump. And the entanglement with the GOP is something we really need to tease out. Congressman George Santos flashed a white power gesture on the House floor. Trump spoke out of both sides of his mouth after Charlottesville. He said there were good people on both sides, and then he tried to walk that back. The Daily Beast reports that in January 2022, several neo-Nazi protests take shape across Florida, including one in Orlando. That's the one we mentioned earlier. At the time, Florida Governor Ron DeSantis slow-walked condemning the protest until national leaders from both major political parties did so. And even when he did, the article goes on, he still insisted that being asked to condemn the condemnable was just a ploy by, quote, these Democrats who are trying to use this as some type of political issue to try to smear me as if I had something to do with that. That came just days after DeSantis's then press secretary and current rapid response director for his presidential campaign was criticized for a since deleted tweet in which she said, do we even know they're Nazis? Or is this a stunt like the white nationalists who crashed the Youngkin rally in Charlottesville and turned out to be Dem staffers? I trust Florida enforcement to investigate and await their conclusions. Wow, there's a lot to pick on there. But Jeff, how fair is it to say, without this level of enabling and without this much power already in place in Congress and earlier in the White House, this just opens doors we probably would not have seen people crashing through before.
I think that's absolutely true. So many of the people I've spoken to felt licensed by it, or not even licensed, drawn into it. It's sad to say, but, you know, the Obama to Trump voter was a real phenomenon. Ashley Babbitt, the so-called martyr of January 6th, was one of them. It's a little bit like the sort of the latent white supremacy that some of these people were kind of resisting. Trump said, not only is it okay, it's wonderful. It's something that I, as a very successful person, have, you know, not quite those explicit terms. You too can give voice to that. And in doing so, you become transgressive. And you mentioned George Santos flashing the white power symbol, which is a kind of an okay symbol. You know, the history of that symbol is really fascinating because it begins as a joke, and that's in scare quotes, a joke in air quotes, to own the libs. And then it's ironic racism, and then it becomes real racism. Ironic racism is real racism. There's always this wobbliness of joking, not joking, and this transgressive power. And I think that's actually really a big distinction between some of the smaller neo-Nazi groups of old that were deadly earnest. And this is what makes figures huge influencers like Andrew Tate, the online influencer, so effective with young men who hear the joking and the not joking, the deniability, and then the kind of the punch that comes by surprise. I think that's what we really want to look at Trump as the performance artist of, and who's made that possible.
And you mentioned something in there, Jeff, that I want to pick up with Charles, and that is a level of posturing. The people who first made that symbol popular were having fun, an ugly sort of fun, but they were having fun. We also see layers of people who are flashing, you know, a white power symbol or doing the Sieg Heil gesture with their hands, who are not sincere. They're play acting and getting out of what they're play acting. What's your sense of how people might be in these groups that are getting something else out of it besides hatred, that might be feeling a sense of community or a sense of fun? Are there people who are more in the game for their own gain as opposed to any true nationalistic or racist issues?
You know, I'm not sure that this is a productive avenue to investigate, in the sense that I think a lot of people who supported Hitler were in for the fun or for you know, the comradeship, or they thought it was Hitler was funny. Hitler was funny. He was a funny looking guy. He did funny things. Just like he was an entertainer, much like Trump is. People are entertained by Trump. But that doesn't mean the deadly serious nature of their movement. And many of them are fully aware that it's also deadly serious. And so that's the way I think of it. Yes, there's fun in terrorizing people. There's fun and humiliating people. There's fun in violence or playing with violence. But no, this is a very serious fascist movement, as Jeffrey would call it. And I think that's the way I would look at it. I think that in terms of enabling, to me, the really interesting thing was Trump's dinner with Nick Fuentes, the sort of neo-Nazi, neo or Holocaust-denying white supremacist. And in the past, you'd have people, a president who, got involved with something like this might try to denial, or a political leader would try denial or subterfuge of some type. I didn't really mean it. Trump came out of that dinner and he said, Nick Fuentes, he gets me. In other words, he came out boasting about it. And this is why, and this was a sense of empowerment for Trump. To me, it's similar to the Hollywood tapes. He doesn't deny, he says, the Hollywood tapes. It's part of his power. Mm-hmm. And so part of Trump's power is embracing fascists, embracing Hitlerites. And this shows he's a strong man. So it's also entertaining. But that doesn't mean it's not deadly serious as well.
That's very interesting. Jeff, you watched as well as Donald Trump played both sides against the middle. And I guess in his case, it doesn't matter whether he's sincere or not, although you can make the case, as you mentioned earlier, if you're acting racist, then you are a racist. But Donald Trump really, really, really didn't know how to tweak people on both sides.
I mean, Trump is a racist. He's an anti-Semite. He's a misogynist, and always has been. In fact, part of, I think, what people don't understand is he's a very, for New Yorkers, he's a very recognizable figure in these hates, which is to say that he lives with the folks that he sees as inferior. He may even work with them, but he's secure in his idea that his whiteness makes him superior to that. Others outside of that kind of sensibility say, well, he has Jewish friends. He has a Jewish son-in-law. He has Black friends, Black supporters, so he can't be racist. And this is a kind of, let's call it a cosmopolitan fascism. I'm mixing terms there. But I think that, and I think the hate is sincere, but I completely agree with Charles. The sincerity is beside the point. And the same way that when folks talk about some of these neo-Nazis, and a lot of liberals like to reassure themselves by saying, oh, these are just a bunch of overweight guys cosplaying. That doesn't matter if they've got a gun. Their weight doesn't have anything to do with the bullet's velocity. The damage is real, regardless of the motivation.
That's a good place to take a break. You're listening to Your Call. I'm Angie Coiro in for Rose today. My two guests, as we discuss both the rise of neo-Nazis and, to a greater extent, fascism in the U.S., Jeff Charlotte, you just heard, journalist, professor of English, and the best-selling author of 7 books, including The Undertow, Scenes from a Slow Civil War. Charles Postol is the author of The Populist Vision and the author of Equality, An American Dilemma, 1866-1896. He's also written about conservative and right-wing nationalist movements in recent U.S. history. When we come back, we're going to open up the phones. We're already starting to get some emails and other questions, so stand by for that. But in the meantime, our staff and friends at KALW have a message for you. We'll be right back. And your call continues here on KALW. We're going to open up the phone lines where people are already checking in. The number to call is 866-798-TALK, 866-798-8255. You can also email us. We're watching the inbox at yourcall@kalw.org. And while we get some of those calls lined up, we're going to continue with Charles and Jeff, our two guests here. We were talking earlier about the attraction that people feel to these groups. One thing we hear a lot with the research on this, people who've embedded themselves and have a chance to get to know these people, they talk about when the belief isn't that strong, the family feeling can be strong. And I bring this up related to my earlier question because it seems as though it might be an in to peel people away from that movement, to maybe start with the folks who aren't that enmeshed, but are looking for friends, or looking for company or comfort. Jeff, does that work?
I have to say, I'm not an evangelical Christian. I'm not an evangelical of any sort. So I don't go, if someone has committed themselves to a group like the Proud Boys or Oath Keepers or another far right movement, if they're part of a militia like some of the folks I met, those are not the folks that I think any of us who care about democracy should be spending our time on. I'm going to really talk you out of this. And in the same way that they're not going to talk me out of my commitment to democracy. I don't see that as realistic. And it also doesn't take into account, allegiances like that are complex, right? You're not going to hit the single magic button that converts somebody. These are not conversion narratives. They are the results of political and practical choices that people make over time. We can make our own choices. We can organize folks who care about democracy, and that's where I want us to put the energy.
All right. Question from Art. I'm going to aim this one at Charles. The first question is, where in world history and in the world has fascism been effectively countered and defeated? Second question, what can we do here in the U.S. to slow down, stop, or defeat fascism? That's from Art. Charles?
I think this may sound overly optimistic, but fascism has been defeated over and over again. And think about in American history, we've had very strong fascist movements in the 1930s, and they were unsuccessful in terms of taking over national power. Now, I don't mean that they were unsuccessful in terms of influencing things and shaping things. They were, and they did a tremendous amount of damage, but they were unsuccessful in taking national power because of people's commitment to democracy, among other things. And I think that that's true. You could almost say that's true of almost every other country that hasn't had a fascist dictatorship. It's because people opposed it and fought back. I think that's a general pattern in many countries. There's a second part to that question.
What can we do specifically? Specifically here in the U.S., what can we do?
Well, I think the real crisis we face is the legitimacy or the opening of to these neo-Nazis and fascist movements as politically okay. And so the very simple answer is we need to mobilize that. No, they're not okay. I mean, advocacy of this type of racial politics leads to genocide. It leads to destruction. It leads to disaster. And we need to emphasize that. And we need to mobilize in defense of in opposition to this type of white nationalist, Christian nationalist, fascist, and neo-Nazi politics. Mm-hmm. And the basic thing I think is if it become, I think the core lesson, and we can look at Europe today. I think if we look at Europe today, in those places where political parties say, no, we're not going to let the neo-Nazis into political power, they're excluded. And it weakens them. And where people say, oh yes, well, you know, for political gain, we'll let you in. It strengthens them and they gain political influence. And I think that same lesson applies here. Is it okay to have dinner with John Fuentes and become the president of the United States? I mean, we have to deal with that. Mm-hmm. That's a major question we need to confront.
Before I go back to the phones, Jeff, you want to get in on that?
I completely agree with Charles, and I'll quote Woody Guthrie, fascism is bound to lose. It always does, but it takes time. It can be beaten. The one thing I'll say, and I think there's a historical model, maybe Charles would want to speak to this as well, is the Popular Front from the 1930s. And I would want to adapt it a little bit to the present, but anyone who is telling us right now, here's our prescription. This is the three-step program we take to beat fascism. That person is selling snake oil. And here's how we know, because we haven't beaten it yet. So I don't know if we should be moving electorally. I don't know if we should be out in the streets. I don't know if we should be organizing in our communities. My answer is wherever you feel called, step up and do it. Don't worry so much about picking the right tactic right now. Just engage in a tactic, because we're gonna be inventing this solution as we go.
Frank in San Francisco, thank you for waiting. You're on the air here with your call. Hi, Frank. I'm not getting Frank here on the line. Oh, there he is. Hello, Frank.
Actually, my name is Robert.
Okay. we're having all kinds of fun technically today. Robert in Novato, I assume. Welcome.
Yes. And this segues into one why I was calling. I just want to mention very quickly is that no one's ever mentioning that Donald Trump's father was a known Ku Klux Klan member and marched with them. But I think we're also failing to recognize that this group becomes smarter. They learn what works and what doesn't work. We probably don't identify one portion of the actual members of the far right and the Nazi ideology that occupy Congress at this time. Does anybody really know the background of Marjorie Taylor Greene, Laura Boebert, Congressman Gomper? I would be very surprised if Ted Cruz doesn't have his hands in it deeply, as well as even potentially Lindsey Graham. So they're sitting in power laughing their heads off, saying, look, see, we've got control. We can control the Congress. We can shut down Congress. Join us. You can stand up. And everyone's terrified of identifying these people for who they are.
Well, you know, Robert, you bring something up that's very important, I think, and that is to find out the backgrounds of these people. We have to count on journalism to do its job. Jeff, let me ask you about this, and that is, do you see coverage where people really have a chance to understand who and what Marjorie Taylor Greene is or who or what Ted Cruz is? Are there backgrounds available enough to the average person so they can look and see things like this?
They are, and we do know about their backgrounds. I write about Lauren Boebert's background in Vanity Fair and this book, but they're not available enough. And Marjorie Taylor Greene's a great example. We saw a 60 Minutes episode, and Leslie Stahl, who was an admirable career in so many ways, giving Marjorie Taylor Greene the same treatment that she's always given rising stars in Congress. Normalizing her. And I think the biggest danger here, and sometimes people say, oh, the New York Times or the Washington Post, they really want Trump to win. No, they don't. I contribute to both. I don't want Trump to win. But you have a lot of journalists who are imagining that if they stick to the old methods, they can somehow drag us back to normal. And that's where I might have like a wrinkle of disagreement with Charles when you say, we can't let this in. Too late. It's in. We're past the moment where we can say, why you can't sit down with Nick Fuentes. Trump has already shown he can. And here, I think, an example that crosses over between journalism and politics, the Never Trumpers. These are the former, mostly senior Republican officials who have drawn the line and are clear-eyed about this. They say, look, this is far-right stuff. The Republican Party is not something we can save now. Mm-hmm. We've just got to, we can't say, Republicans, remember who you are. They're not that anymore. And journalists need to recognize that too and call it out.
Right. And the Republicans who were that are pretty much left at this point. Back to the phones. Frank, thank you for your patience. You are now, in fact, on the air.
Okay, good morning. Well, I'd like to ask your guest if they ever heard, which is very, you hear all the time, very often in the international media, about Donald Trump working with a group, extremist, they call themselves Afrocentrics, which mean all Africa was black at one time, and all black Americans will go back to Africa. It is his promise, we heard that from his mouth many times before, he would make America white again. You hear that all over. It's also linked to all of the unrest you see in Sudan, in Niger, in many other countries, because they are trying to make room for the so-called black American to go back to Africa. I don't know why this is not big news in the American media, but it is hush, hush, hush. I'd like to get some feedback if any of your guests have heard about that. Thank you, always. Great show at KLAW. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much. It's very good to have had your question on the air. And an Afrocentric group and the pursuit of a more white America. Charles, have you heard that at all?
Well, it's a longstanding thing. I mean, this has been going on for decades in terms of politics. And people may remember George Lincoln. Older people remember George Lincoln Rockwell's connections to the Nation of Islam and how that worked out. I don't know if it's particularly influential or effective right now, this Back to Africa connections to the right wing, but it's a long-term thing, and I'm sure it's still out there.
And what about Donald Trump in relation to that, Jeff?
I think we're those of us on the sort of the pro-democracy side, the liberal side, the left side, wherever you want to put it, one of the things we have to do is that when our friends and fellow travelers make an error, we have to call it out. No, the Afrocentric movement is not influential with the MAGA movement. And no, as a correction, Donald Trump has never said make America white again. He's got a different white supremacist project that is more complicated and bigger and more dangerous. So, Donald Trump as president is involved in all kinds of unrest in Africa, as every president before him and after. The United States is in a big power, and we mess around with a lot of countries. But no, that's not part of the project. We don't have to look at any conspiracies around Donald Trump. Mm-hmm. He's putting it all right out there. It's visible. And I think Charles sort of mentioned this, that he's sort of bragging about who he is. He's telling us who he is. So we don't have to go saying, well, what's the true story? The true story is right in front of us, and that's the one we need to contend with.
I want, in fact, to go to the idea of true stories and the fact that we have all kinds of realities out there today. There's that saying that you're entitled to your opinion, but you're not entitled to your own facts. But we're living in an era where people have their own facts and they live with that. To the point where we're talking about Hillary Clinton actually being a reptile with a mask on. That may sound insane, but the number of people who believe it is daunting. When Ashley Babbitt was killed, and the word started going around as to what kind of plot it was to get her killed, how they forced her through a window, per se, to give them better aim. You have other cases like that. I want to go back to Christina Pushaw, DeSantis's then press secretary, who was saying that at the rally in Charlottesville, it was Democratic staffers who were fighting the white nationalists. There are all kinds of issues where people see their own reality. The young man who crashed into the White House barriers had a flag with him, and the word came out afterward that, well, that was put in there by Photoshop. That wasn't really there. It's so hard to distinguish between reality and fact, and it's even harder to take those people who've gone into the deep end where facts don't live and try to get them to understand what's going on. I'm sure, Charles, you've seen this in history any number of times.
Well, I was going to speak to the present, long history, like as in the Obama birth certificate fuss with Trump. What Trump is a master of is that lying has power. His ability to lie, blatantly lie, shows that he's a powerful person. Mm-hmm. And this is part of what I think Jeffrey would call his fascism. Contempt for truth, but it's also it's a signifier of power for them, and their followers have taken this up. The most outlandish, if the lie is outlandish, it shows greater power, mm-hmm. and that's part of what's going on in this thing. And I agree with Jeff, by the way. I think the horse is out of the barn when it comes to the Republican Party. I think that the Republican Party has been taken over by this movement, and the horse is way out of the barn. It's more the question of what he's urging, his critique of the media. We need something new. We need different ways to expose what's going on and to fight back.
And what we have seen exposed so far, Jeff, is not getting as much traction. Donald Trump is by far the person who leads the Republicans as the desired presidential candidate. So even with facts available out there, he's still appealing to people despite his fascism.
Well, because as Charles says, not despite, because of his fascism, what Charles says about powers is absolutely right. The one essential fact about Donald Trump for his followers is really true. It is a fact, which it is an expression of power. right? Mm-hmm. I think there's a terrific book called The Book of Jerry Falwell. Older listeners remember Jerry Falwell, one of the leaders of the 1980s religious right around Reagan. And an anthropologist, Susan Friend Harding, went and spent time at his church. And she noticed that he would tell the same stories Sunday to Sunday, and they'd often have variations. So you could hear the lies happening in real time. So does this disenchant his followers? No, it makes them feel like they're a part of the construction of his authority. They are collaborating with him. And I've been to many Trump rallies. I've seen that happen. I've seen people say, oh, yeah, I know that's not true. Or I know he can't say what he really thinks there. But that's okay. I'm in on it. I'm part of the initiated. So thus, I'm getting a piece of the power. So I think that is where we're at in terms of those alternate realities. A little bit of sort of journalism trying to fact check Trump. It doesn't work. You can't fact check a myth. They're not selling a data analysis. They're selling one fact, which is power, and any other story that serves it.
He's really got down what's known as the Gish Gallop. By the time you're done contradicting or establishing facts around the first thing he said, he's down there saying the 20th thing, and fact-checking with him is pointless. It's truly pointless. To another question, and that is, who is speaking up against this? Who can people who are interested see as allies they might be able to help? And I'm thinking in terms of giving money to organizations or, you know, going to marches or other demonstrations that are put together by credible groups. Let's talk about A, who's speaking up, and B, how people can contribute their own money, time, and energy. Charles, tell me about what you know here.
You know, I'm going to go back to what Jeffrey said about, I think here's a really good time to do everything. We need to do everything we can, and people have to find what they're comfortable with and press at that point. I don't have a solution. I don't have an answer. In certain ways, there are features of today that history just doesn't tell us what you're supposed to do except to challenge what's happening. I think some really exciting things that are happening, and just simply, I think defending the vote is really important. This is part of this movement. Its strength is that it's a minority rule movement. It has the majority of voters reject them. And I think that is an important thing. And to defend the vote, find ways to defend the vote. Here in California, we forget the challenges of voting in many places. But to engage in that is pretty important to me. And find any other way to push back against minority rule, which is essential to this movement.
Jeff, is part of pushing against minority rule, is part of that trying to persuade people that it's still worth voting? If they see Donald Trump in the lead, you can imagine a lot of people just staying home.
Yeah, I think you're right. And of course, as Charles says, I'm for however you want to get involved, really, however you want to get involved. That said, maybe I'd add a specific wrinkle from my perspective as a journalist. I see all the time, folks, I'll be out there publicly making a critique, say, of the New York Times. I got in a public debate with a New York Times reporter who said we shouldn't use the F word, fascism, or even the R word, racism. And I got in a debate with that. And people said, well, that's why I canceled my subscription. And I'm like, wow, you really stuck it to Trump with that. there's a little bit of media literacy where we're imagining big news organizations as being defined by an individual voice within them that we disagree with, or, you know, a general failing, not recognizing these are resources we are going to need. Fascism has thrived on the death of local papers. I remember in Layton, Utah, I was at a VFW and met an old guy, and he was talking about he was harumphing and everything. And I said, what's wrong? We were talking politics, and he holds up his local newspaper. And I said, oh, I figure he's a right winger. I say, you mean fake news? And he says, no. He opens the paper. It's 4 pages long. There's nothing in it. There's no news. He said, We gave up our news to those machines, the phone, right? You give up that local engagement, even when it's inadequate and infuriating. You want to do something? Maybe I would suggest subscribe to your local paper. If it stinks, make it better.
Ah, I really appreciate that, Jeff. I think that's so important. And Charles, you brought so much to the discussion. I thank you both. Thanks for making time.
Thank you.
Thanks, Annie.
Jeff Charlotte is a journalist and professor of English, director of creative writing at Dartmouth. He's a best-selling author or editor of 7 books. Charles Postol has Equality, An American Dilemma, 1866 to 1896, and The Populist Vision on his book list. He's also a professor of history at San Francisco State University. Thank you so much for tuning in. I would like to let you know that you can hear past shows of Your Call by going to yourcallradio.org. While you're there, you can sign up for our podcast. You can find us on iTunes. You can give us a review there. We are still on Twitter at Your Call Radio. You can email show ideas and feedback to yourcall@kalw.org. Malehi Razazan, I can't talk today. I have no idea why. I do know who she is. Malehi Razazan put the show together with help today from Jalen Herdman. Kevin Vance is our studio engineer. Thank you for joining us. I'm Angie Coiro in for Rose today. It's Your Call.